Future Partiers. It's Anna David here. How are you? I myself, I think I'm good. You know, it's been an interesting 2014. More highs and lows than I had on drugs. I don't know about you guys, but I could use a little bit more serenity. You know what I mean? Just in the day-to-day. Big news coming down the pike, lots of exciting things happening, some hard stuff. You know, it's amazing. You sort of think that you're in recovery. You tell yourself you sort of got it together, and then you just get hit with, a lot of emotions and a lot of information that your life is not exactly the way you want it to be. Anyway, I'm being vague and I'm not meaning to be vague. If you have any desire to even know what I'm talking about, I kind of write extensively and obsessively about these things. So you can see on After Party Chat, a number of articles where I do some navel gazing on this and other topics. But yeah, life is weird. And even when you have a lot of sobriety, that is, it doesn't get unweird in my experience. And, this is the week we're in the wake of hearing about the tragic loss of Philip Seymour Hoffman. And that is something that I get into with my guest, who is an amazing guy. This is like this is the kind of guy superlatives were invented for. His name is Rich Roll. He went to Stanford undergrad, Cornell Law School, built this high-powered law career and was an alcoholic, is an alcoholic, got sober. Then after, sort of like living that dream, getting it together, had the two DUIs, got sober, got the family, got the law career, realized when he was about to turn 40 that he was hopelessly out of shape and was like eating fast food and all that stuff that isn't even really food. And he decided to try to change his life in the way that he had earlier in terms of getting sober. And he took it, as alcoholics sometimes can, further than many would. And when I say he took it further, what I mean by that is that he has completed several Ultramans. Now, an Ultraman is like an Ironman, but a lot freaking harder. It's a 3-day, 320-mile thing that happens in Hawaii. So he did it once. Some of us might do that once, maybe, and hope not to die. He did it, and he was the third fastest American in it. He finished the 11th place. I don't know how many people did it, but a lot, okay? And then he just became obsessed with being in the best possible shape he could. He's been named, one of the 25 fittest men. He's been called, I've heard him called, the fittest man alive, which is to say that I have the fittest man alive in here, in this very room where I'm now sitting alone. So lucky me. And the thing is, so he's somebody that I knew from when I, when I came around and got sober. He was one of the, the stalwarts. He was around. He was somebody who was doing it already. And then he reached out to me a few years ago when he had a book coming out. And he and I, and when there's somebody you haven't talked to in a while and he reaches out to you and tells you he's got this thing going on and you Google him and it says that he's one of the world's fittest men, that got my attention. And, we reconnected over that. His book was phenomenally successful and he has gone on to a, he has a hit podcast, he has a blog, he sells products, he advocates, for himself. He eats, it's a solely plant-based diet. And he's a fascinating guy. And I bring him to you today, you guys, because I like to bring you fascinating people. So with that, I will give you the one and only Rich Roll.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God, I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal, I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
I like starting it by talking about all the things people do wrong as guests on this.
Oh, as guests? Or well, in like sobriety?
Well, in life. Wow. No, but yeah, I... So, Rich, hi.
How's it going?
really good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
I don't remember. When was the last time we saw each other?
It's been a really long time. I was trying to remember. I think the last time I saw you might have been years ago at Heath Slane's Beach House on 4th of July. You were with Peter M. Peter M.
Yes. Yeah. You know what's funny?
Who I saw last night, by the way.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. He has a new haircut.
He always has a new haircut. Yeah. That's sort of what you can count. You can't count on a lot with Peter M., but you can count on the new haircut.
Yeah.
That's funny because that is my sole memory of talking to you. Was like, we talked. Because, okay, keep in mind, when I met you, I was, for a year, I was just in my haze of early sobriety. Nothing registered. There were tall men around. Right. And, like, sometimes I knew their names, but mostly not. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then I definitely remember that 4th of July because I remember we were, I didn't know whose house it was, but I remember I was hanging out with Peter and we were at the beach and then it was this party that was not on the beach. It was not on the beach, right, but we were on a roof.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember we talked, and I had never talked to you really.
No, not really. I mean, I'd seen you around, but I just remember, I was like, oh, wow, she's like a real writer, you know? Because I was sort of this closet aspiring writer at the time.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, she actually has like stuff going on, and look, she's with Peter, and he's going to develop her stuff into a movie, you know?
Looks can be deceiving. Yeah. Although I will say that Peter did give me I did do a one screenwriting job for, that I got paid to do, and that came through Peter.
Maybe that's what we talked about.
Disastrously.
I'm not sure.
Oh yeah, I was probably bragging incessantly. Uh-huh. I'm glad that I could pull the wool over your eyes. And
I know. So we haven't seen each other in a while.
No,
but I feel
but there was much
intimately connected to you.
Well, yes.
Because when my book was getting ready to come out, I was like, I was baffled at how I was supposed to manage the process of marketing my book and getting people interested in it. And I was like, who do I know that's written books? And I was like, Anna's written books. I haven't talked to her in ages. I don't know if she even remembers who I am, but I'm going to reach out to her. You were very, very helpful. You gave me some great input and advice.
I did. I mean, I'm so negative.
And you put me in touch with Tyson Cornell, who's become a friend.
Oh, great. He's such a good guy. Mm-hmm. So did I tell you, I said hire Tyson if you're smart? Is that?
Yeah, I didn't end up hiring him for a variety of reasons, but we became buddies and you know, touched base
such
from
a good
time
guy.
To time. So,
yeah,
good. He's very cool.
But it's interesting because I definitely remember you reaching out to me and me going, oh my God, like I can't give this guy is so accomplished. I don't have anything to offer. And I'm so negative about book publishing. I'm even more negative now.
Yeah, but that's good information to know. Like here's what to avoid. Here's what you can expect and not expect. Because I thought, I'm like, oh, I have this book coming out and it's with a major publishing house and they're just going to send me my itinerary of all the places where I'm going to travel
and talk
about my book and they're going to arrange everything. And you were like, not so fast. And sure enough, I mean, I had a pretty charmed experience with my publisher but the marketing really falls on you as the writer to make it happen. And you made that very clear to me. And I took it and you're like,
I'm going like, to go on Sanjay.
Well, I mean, I worked as hard on marketing it, probably harder than I did on writing the book. And
yeah.
I think that's what most writers don't realize. Like you've got to cultivate your own audience. You've got to make them interested. And you know, all of that is really on you. It's not, you can't dispatch that to somebody else.
But also in terms of your, you know, sort of good experience, you had something to market that was fascinating. Most people don't. Most people have a book come out and it's, you know what I mean? So imagine not having all that material. I mean, that's where...
But you know as well as I do that when you're writing, especially something that's memoir-oriented, you have those shame spiral moments of thinking, who could possibly be interested in this drivel that I'm putting down on paper, you know?
Well, my life is a series of shame spirals, so you don't need to tell me. But yours... But the nice thing about yours is it's inarguably interesting when only a few people... have had this experience when you're the only person and when you know it's motivating to a whole lot of people, right?
But I didn't know that at the time.
You didn't?
No, I didn't know. I didn't know if anybody would be interested in the book. And the book's gone on to be very successful, and I couldn't be happier about that. But certainly, you know, I'm not wired to be naturally self-confident. My default position is self-loathing and self-defeatist and all of those things. So, you know, sort of combating that and trying to overcome that that's the challenge,
the
right?
Life's work.
That's the challenge of recovery.
I know that's true. But I mean, yeah, but amazing. So you can be one of, you know, the world's fittest man and be grappling with, you know.
To be clear, not that I actually believe that I am or was, but that... definitely helps sell books.
So I'll take it.
It was okay. I have these facts in front of me. You placed 11th place in your very first Ultraman, making you the third fastest American and the second fastest swimmer. And it was a 3-day, 320-mile situation, which you've now done many times.
Yeah, I've done a couple times now. It's like a really long triathlon. People who are listening who don't know what that is, you probably know what an Ironman is. An Ironman is a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike, and a marathon all in one day. And Ultraman is a race that is held every year, Ultraman World Championships in Hawaii. And it's essentially a little over twice that distance, but you do it over 3 days, and you circumnavigate the Big Island of Hawaii. So I've done that race a couple times.
Is that what you mean? Is a couple times? You've done it twice.
I did it in 2008, and then I did it in 2009, and I got sixth in that race. And then I went back in 2011, and I ended up DNFing. I had a respiratory infection.
What's DNFing
mean? It means I had to stop in the middle of the race. I pulled out, because I was, coughing up blood.
Right.
But
but when it goes quote unquote well, you are up for 3 days doing this, and then your body.
Well,
does
it's like
what
a stage race, you know, like in the Tour de France, they race and then they go to bed and then they race
do
the
that?
Next day. So this is like that. Like you do a stage and then you go to sleep and you wake up and you do another stage. So the first day, you swim 6.2 miles and you ride your bike 90 miles, and then the second day, you ride your bike 170 miles, and then the third day, you do a 52-mile run, and so you kind of go all the way around the Big Island, which is a big island. It's like the size of Connecticut.
And you sleep like wherever you they figured out where you're going to land. And just you have, in this place?
Well, each athlete has to bring their own crew. So it's very old school. They don't even shut the traffic off. There's no prize money or there's no big media attention in this race. It's very grounded.
You got to be dedicated. You can't be in it for the cash and prizes.
So each athlete has a van that kind of follows them around and takes care of their athlete. And then there's a place to stay each night. So,
Not that scenic. I'm picturing you running for 3 days straight. I don't know. I don't know anything about this. But I do
Nor
know.
Should
so,
you.
So, okay. But to go, let's go back even further because, for all that you've written, and you were such a good writer, I cannot believe you ever doubted yourself as a writer.
Oh, thank you.
That you actually, I haven't read a lot that you have written about the addiction phase. Mm-hmm. It does sort of get, not glossed over, that's the wrong phrasing, but you haven't gone as into it as, of course, that's my obsession, And it is hard to reconcile with this, guy who's been successful at seemingly everything he's tried,
That's so not the case, though. I mean,
but you get how at least it looks
on
paper.
You can kind of craft the story and frame it so that it looks like this, upward trajectory. But it's, as in sobriety and in life and everything, it's not a linear thing, Looking back, it looks like it all happened really quickly and easily, but it definitely wasn't. And I tell my addiction story in the book, and I do talk about it, and I'm open about it.
Right,
we were kind
of
chatting before we started recording about this kind of issue of anonymity and the tradition of anonymity that envelops recovery and how that is sort of a global thing and also a very personal thing. Like, we have decision-making power of our own personal anonymity, but not that we don't really – that doesn't extend to other people. And how do you talk about recovery and how do you talk about addiction without – transgressing
tradition. Especially when 12-step, there is no expert, there is no scholar, there is no board you can call and say, hey, is it okay if I say this but I don't say that, and there are a lot of opinion, alcoholics and all people tend to be very opinionated, and so you just by even saying publicly that you're an alcoholic, that could ruffle somebody's feathers, and they could tell you that that's wrong.
When I write about it, I don't even know if it's okay for me to say Alcoholics Anonymous or just say recovery. Am I transgressing the parameters of that tradition by even mentioning the name? I don't know.
Did you mention that in your book? I'm scared to even say it.
Maybe I did one or two times,
right.
But I was trying to kind of cautious about it because I don't, my only goal is I want to be of service and help people.
Right, exactly.
And if I'm personally anonymous about it, then I'm not able to be of service to people through writing or podcasts. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, you're talking to someone who has received an email and the from field said Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. So I once got a letter. It's funny. I can't remember if I've talked about this on the podcast
from
before.
From the boss of AA.
I got one from AA. Yeah. And it basically said to me, I read it and I was so freaked out that I got it that I just sort of closed it and never went back to it. But I can search and find, and I haven't done that. But it basically said, like, we know you're talking about us. Please try to behave. Mm-hmm. Kind of a thing.
But what does that mean?
That's what I didn't know. And so, you know, my whole thing about it was when I wrote my first book, which was a novel, I fictionalized everything. I was just mm-hmm. paranoid because I felt a little betrayed by a lot of the memoirs I'd read that had said, like, given addresses of meetings and talked about these things. So I did it, and I'm not sure I did it right, but I changed the language. I called sponsor something else. I called step something else, but mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about what had happened. And then when I started working at The Fix, I said, I'll do this job, but I won't ever talk about AA. And then we started doing that website. And
but how can you be The Fix and not talk about it?
Well, that's what I was naive. And yeah. So that people immediately started talking, you know, AA is the worst, you know, because the AA haters like went out yeah. and drove to that site. And so then I realized, you know, if there's nothing to defend it, I will do it. But I get nervous every single time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. You know, I'm sure for every kind of email like that, like the AA email that you received, you probably get countless emails from people saying, thank you for writing what you wrote. It touched me. And, you know, now, like, you know, I have a clearer idea of what addiction or alcoholism is. And, you know, I'm looking at my own, you know, behaviors right. and now I'm trying to redress them. So when you receive emails like that and you know that you're affecting people in a positive way, you know, that's the counterpoint to that.
How many emails like that do you get?
I get countless. Every single day I get emails from people.
But is it about addiction or is it about, you know, getting healthy?
It's both, you know, because my book is weird. It's like trying to be three or four books in one, you know, like
right,
where
right.
I have the addiction. It's sort of like this million little pieces, you know, kind of permanent midnight aspect to it. And then it has the kind of Lance Armstrong, it's not about a bike. It's not
right.
about the bike aspect to
right.
it. And then it has a kind of a self-help dietary, you know, kind of how-to guide to it.
Right.
So it's kind of balancing all these different things. But and certain, so there isn't one clear definitive audience for it, but there's, you know, people out there that are interested in the recovery aspect of it. And I get emails all the time. And on my podcast, I have guests on and we get into it.
Yeah. Oh, I saw you on Mishka Shibali.
Yeah. Oh, you do? I'm going to see him next week in New York.
So
him if he knew you and he said, because you guys are the kings of the Kindle single.
Yeah, he said it like that. He said it all, like he was trying to remember. We totally know
each
other.
Okay. Yeah, he was like, I think I met her once. Like he knows you from like online and your work.
No,
but
he's great. No, we have hung out. That's
all
ludicrous.
Right. We should call him right now.
Yeah. I want if my name comes up for him to go, not like this vague, weird look on his face, like, I think I met her once. No, we hung out.
Not in condescending way.
Right.
Like in a more like, oh, she knows more than I do kind of way.
No. The first call you make mm-hmm. if you get assigned a Kindle single is to Mishka Shibali if you're lucky.
Right.
You know, basically it was like I met with the editor about doing it and I said I reached out to Mishka right away and he was super helpful.
Right, okay.
And
cool.
Then we sort of became friends. I felt we were friends. Maybe I need to reassess.
No, I think you are friends. But I'm going to New York unless my plane gets snowed out this weekend and I'm gonna hang out with him. But he's one of those guys who like I started reading his stuff
like,
oh, this guy's my best friend already.
Yeah.
And then I met him and it was like we knew each other forever, so we text almost every day. And
yeah, I can totally see
he's
that.
He's my guy.
Okay, you're closer to him than me.
I love him.
It's fun. No, his writing is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. He's so good. And yeah, and I'm not surprised that you two connected. So did you reach out to him when you read something?
We were put in. I knew who he was, and also because his book would always come up when I would obsessively check Amazon.
Oh yeah, the longest run.
Yeah, like
right.
The long run was always like a notch above mine. And I was
right.
Like, who is this guy?
Yeah,
like, this
exactly.
Kindle single,
this
you know,
30-page thing.
We were introduced by another podcasting guy actually, who was like this guy Dean Dwyer. He's like, you should interview Mishka. And
yeah.
I reached out to him, and like we just had a couple snarky emails back and forth.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I love this guy already.
But did you do it over the phone?
I was going to New York. No,
oh,
so
good.
We did it. We've actually done three podcasts together.
Oh my God.
I mean, if he lived in LA, he would be like my co-host.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Because I could talk to him forever. But
yeah.
But with Mishka and with a few other people, we've gotten into the, you know, the addiction and recovery stuff. And I love talking about that. And you know, I know that it's helpful to people because I get too many emails that make it undeniable. So,
right.
you know, you and I, we've made a choice to not be anonymous about our recovery and our sobriety. And that has its own perils.
Right. You know? When did you make that choice?
I made it.
When you were writing
I think I was writing, you know, I would reference it in blogging occasionally, but it wasn't until I wrote my book.
Right, and then you had to make a conscious choice.
I'm like, yeah, and I was making that conscious choice. And what happened was, you know, I'm writing, I get this book deal, which, you know, first of all, like, you know, I'm astounded that I even got a book deal.
Okay, so what happened? So you were blogging and you were gathering an audience.
I was gathering an audience through writing on my website and, you know, sort of sharing very honestly and openly, like this journey that I was on. And then when I started to perform quite well in these races, then, you know, sort of more mainstream media was picking up the story. And
right.
and then Men's Fitness ran this thing and said I was one of the 25 fittest guys. And so suddenly I was getting all this attention, you know, right. where I was just like, I'm just doing my thing.
Right.
And then CNN, like Sanjay Gupta picked up the story and ran a story about me. And so suddenly I was like, you know, kind of more in the spotlight than I ever imagined I ever would be.
Right.
And actually the book deal came about in a very recovery oriented way. It's a very cool story. What happened was there was an article about me in the Stanford Alumni Magazine. Mm-hmm. And it said, you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic, and kind of told it was a short little article. And then I got an email out of the blue from a guy who I want to be careful because I want to protect his anonymity, but he was a guy that I didn't really know, who was a couple of years older than me at school, but I knew who he was. Mm-hmm. But we had never, I don't know that we had ever actually met in person, but I knew his name. And he reached out to me. He's like, hey, I read that story. I'd love to talk to you. Can I call you? And I was like, okay. He was kind of a big deal on campus.
Right.
And so we ended up talking, and he was like, I'm a executive at a big company. I'm CEO, you know, and my company's getting ready to, you know, do big things. And I just got out of Hazleton.
Wow.
And my board of directors doesn't know. Nobody knows, you know, my family knows and all of
right.
that. But like, I'm under a lot of stress and, you know, I don't have a sponsor. And
right.
you know, I'm just, he was literally like a week out of rehab or something like
right.
that.
Right.
So I said, listen, you got to get a sponsor, but I'm happy to talk to you. And we would talk on and off, you know, over the next couple months and, just, you know, trying to impart whatever experience I could to him. And then one day he was like, hey, you know, I used to, rent this house from this book agent. Your story is so compelling. Like, you know, I think you should talk to her. You know, she might be really interested in your story. I was like, okay. And I'd thought about doing a book, but it was seemed like such a far-fetched reality for
right.
me. So it wasn't like I had some book proposal all ready to go. So I spoke to this book agent and I said, here's kind of the thumbnail of my story. And she's like, that's pretty interesting. You know, I'd be into exploring this. I'm like, why don't we work on a proposal together? So I busted my butt for like 3 months on a proposal and, you know, wrote it like my life depended on it. I just got really into it. And then she was like, well, publishing is so hard, you know, you got to thread the needle and,
right.
you know, it's kind of like the movie business. If you're not making like Shrek 3 or like, you know, the Avengers, they're not interested, you
right.
know, so it has to be a very specific thing. And she was very, not pessimistic, but sort of cautious, like, you know, I'll do my best and we'll see what happens. And I ended up selling the book in like, you know, 48 hours, you know, sort of like a preemptive bid. And it was like, it all happened. Like, it was like this divinely, you know, graced experience where
right.
it all came together and I got this amazing editor at the great, you know, at Crown Random House.
Right.
Like, it was the best of all worlds. You know,
right.
it was like everything.
And that agent sold it even though she was not.
Yeah, she sold it. Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
So it all worked out, but yeah. it was all because of basically extending yourself and being of service to somebody
right.
in the program.
Right.
You know what I mean? So
right.
it's that spiritual equation of when you're giving, when you're of service, you get back tenfold.
Yeah. yeah.
And that, like,
not always in the
life.
Form of a book deal.
No,
sometimes
yeah, I know. Like, that's a very, like, yeah, I mean, they say, like, when you get sober, you know, that's what you get. You get sober. It's not like you're promised some beautiful, amazing life. But I know
right.
that the more I am of service, that, you know, my life is richer and better. And that doesn't mean that you get a book deal or a
right.
Ferrari or, you know, whatever. But
right.
it means you have a chance at a good life.
Yeah, yeah. Or even the, you know, the children and the
exactly.
family and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so where are you from, Rich?
Washington, D.C.
Yeah. So you raised there, and family is, you know, very education is focused? Yeah. What was the sort of
pretty traditional values? Pretty traditional. You know, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic house. My parents are still together. My needs were always met. When I was in high school, we started off middle class, and my dad he was a lawyer, and you know, he got more and more successful each year. Upper middle class by the time I graduated high school.
And brothers? And,
I have one sister.
One sister,
yeah, one younger sister. I went to private high school, coat and tie.
Oh, know, that kind of private high school, okay. Yeah. All boys? No.
All boys. Okay. Yeah, all boys high school. But I was, you know, I was a loner kid. You know, I was always sort of self-conscious and... you know, when I was younger, I had a patch on one eye and the headgear, and you know, I was not a vision for you.
Right.
You know, I was very insecure.
What was wrong with your little eye?
I have a wandering eye.
Oh, you do? I can't see it at all.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It goes on. Yeah.
Okay. Too bad. Yeah. Listeners
that's
can't
good
see that.
Yeah.
Creepy thing. I didn't see anything, by the way.
But it's, you know, the typical thing of like, you know, feeling like everyone else has the rule book to life and you don't.
Right.
And I discovered the sport of swimming when I was about 12 years old, and it was the first thing that I was ever good at, you know, and I kind of took to that, and it was this womb-like experience because I could go to the pool and I could be away from the bullies, and when your head's underwater, you know, no one can bug you. And
were they picking on you?
Yeah, I was a little bit of a... I was on the receiving end of... I was a very nerdy, like, awkward-looking kid. But you know, I really gave myself to that sport. And in certain respects, you can make the argument that that was like my first drug of choice.
Right.
You know, I just went all in on that.
So every day after school, that's what you did.
I got up every morning at 4:45 and I went to swim practice and went to school and then went to swim practice after school for another 2 hours.
Right.
So I was like training like 3 to 4 hours a day.
Right.
And by the time I graduated high school, and then, you know, I wasn't a great student, but then my grades picked up. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I was a top student at my school. And I was a top swimming recruit, you know, so I was getting recruited by all these colleges, and I wasn't into drugs and alcohol in high school because I was training so much. But then I started going on these recruiting trips, and they basically, you know, designed the party for you. And,
and that was because they're all wooing you.
Yeah.
So what was your first drink? What was that like?
The first time I got drunk, I was visiting University of Michigan. And it was they had had a big swim meet and then a big party afterwards. And I'll never forget being at this party. And it was the middle of winter, and I was given a beer and like a giant big gulp cup.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, all right, you know, I'm going to do this. And I drank it, and it was that trite thing that you always hear of just feeling like the warm blanket being, you know, enveloping you, and suddenly the lights going on and thinking, this is amazing. You know, this is the solution to every problem that I didn't know that I had.
Right.
And just suddenly comfortable in your own skin. I could look at a girl in the eye and flirt and tell a joke. And I was laughing with people and I was comfortable around other people because I was always like a wallflower if I even went to a party, which was rarely.
Right.
So, and the one thing that happened that was remarkable was, in the middle of this party, there was a guy called Bruce Kimball, and he was a very, very famous decorated diver, Olympic champ. I don't know if he was a gold medalist. I think he got a silver medal in like 84. I'm not sure. But a terrible alcoholic. And he had, I'm going to botch all the facts, but he had, gotten into a lot of trouble with his drinking, and I think it had already progressed at this point. And I saw him hold a plastic cup of beer that he got from the keg, and then do a standing backflip holding this beer and land on his feet, and he didn't spill the beer.
Right.
And I thought that was the coolest thing that I had ever seen.
Right.
And this guy went on, I think a couple years after this, and he crashed his car head on into a bunch of people. He killed some people and ended up in jail and, you know, basically destroyed his life. And I think he's sober now. I'm not sure exactly what he's doing, but it was this horribly tragic incident. And his father was the Olympic diving coach.
Oh my God.
So, you know, here's the guy that I'm looking at. Like that is, I want to be like that guy.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? And to see what had happened to him later.
I think you need to have him on your podcast,
so,
by the way.
I would like to
I'd
do
like
that.
To see that.
I think you should have him on your podcast
yeah,
too.
Yeah, we could both. We could share him. Mm-hmm. So you're on that trip and you have your first drink and you see this, you know, that this is the life you can lead. and you then, what happens after that?
Well, it was a slow progression. Right. I mean, I ended up like, you know, by the time, what happened was I got into every college, you know, I got into every college I applied to. I got into Harvard, I got into Princeton, and I ended up going to Stanford.
Right.
So I left, I was like, I'm going to California, you know, I want to get away as far away from the East Coast as possible. And at the time, Stanford had the number one swimming program in the country, and I was going to go to Harvard, where I would have been a standout, you know, person on the team right away. And at Stanford, there were Olympic gold medalists and world record holders, and I was kind of going to be a walk-on if I went there. But I was like, I'm going to be the little fish in the big pond. Like, I got to give it a go. And when I got there, I just got enamored with partying, you know.
Right.
And so it was a slow degradation of, you know, everything aspirational in my life. And the first thing that drinking did was that it destroyed my swimming career. I swam all right my freshman year, and then after that, I really never swam fast again. And all of my kind of dreams and hopes, like I was going to be a doctor, and I just forgot about all that stuff. And all I cared about was, you know, where's my next good time?
Did you stay on the team the whole time?
I didn't swim my senior year, so I quit. Yeah,
right.
I quit.
I have a question. So going back, you didn't grow up in an alcoholic family. Was there alcoholism somewhere in your family?
There are hints around the edges here and there, but no, there was never any, but there was never somebody in the family where you're like, oh, stay away from uncle or whoever, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I didn't grow up around it,
right.
You know, and it wasn't in my experience, and I, you know, there was no abuse in my family and or anything like that. So,
And what about this, dedication to athletics? Was that something, or was that also something that was unusual about you?
There was no one else in my family who is that dedicated to sports or athletics, but it was a very achievement-oriented household.
Right.
Like, I definitely grew up with pressure to perform academically and always trying to kind of grab that carrot or always feeling like you're falling short and, you know, never kind of feeling like, you know, you've made it or getting kind of that feeling of security around that.
Yeah, I relate to that. And it's, you know, and it's a hard thing in life because if you didn't ever get that, it's hard to start giving that to yourself even when you are, you know, because your brain is just always like, well, who cares? There's somebody better, you know? Did you graduate okay from Stanford even though you were, you know?
I graduated okay. I mean, I was a functioning alcoholic for many years, you know, and I was able to, by the hair of my chinny chin chin, like get into law school and, you know.
So when you said your dreams, like you wanted to be a doctor and so your dad was a lawyer. So you thought, okay, well, the doctor thing, I didn't do pre-med clearly.
Right.
But I could go to law school. Is that how that came about?
Yeah, it wasn't like, oh, I have this fascination with the law.
Right.
It was more like, that's a stand-up thing to do that I can receive, you know, a pat on the back and it's socially acceptable and I get to wear a nice suit and have nice lunches. It wasn't like the practice of law was all that alluring. It was more like, this is a safe thing to do.
Do you think the practice of law is all that alluring to anybody?
I think there are certain people for whom it is and God bless them, you know. But I think there are a lot of at least corporate lawyers out there sort of suffering quietly.
Yeah. So you went to Cornell for law school. So you go back.
I was the last person accepted off the wait list.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I barely got in. And so I figured if I don't graduate last in my class, then that's a move up.
Did you do it? Did you succeed?
I did. I don't know where in the class I graduated, but I did. I did fine.
Guy.
But I was, you know, I really like ramped up the drinking when I lived in New York City for a couple of years after college, and that's really, you know, that's
a good
like
place
Disneyland
to do it.
For alcoholics, you know, no car, you can walk around the street drinking and after hours parties that go till 5 a.m., you know, whatever.
Right.
So I definitely tapped into that, you know, and that was really where it clicked into like a higher gear of like getting into trouble.
And how did you get in trouble?
More not trouble with the law, really.
Your,
I mean, bar fights and stuff like that, but
but
really just like sort of digging a hole for my spirit mostly, you know, I think. And then thinking I'm going to go to law school and it was geographic, you know. I'm going to be in this small town. I'm going to be away from Manhattan. I'll be able to focus. I'll be in a structured environment. And of course that, you know, doesn't really work.
Just alcohol though. You weren't doing drugs.
Yeah, pretty much a purist. Mm-hmm. I feel insecure about that.
Yeah,
like,
I don't blame you.
And to be clear, unusual. Like my story is pretty pedestrian. You know, like I got into trouble and I reached some pretty dark, low places, especially at the end. And there's some crazy drama that occurred around that, and a wedding that went awry, and all kinds of nonsense.
Yeah. I want to hear that story.
That's like a 4-hour podcast.
Well, okay, but because it's somewhere that like it went right on the honeymoon.
It did. I ended up sending my supposed wife home in the middle of the honeymoon.
How did that happen?
It's such a. In order to like understand what happened, I'd have to fill in so many details. But essentially, what happened was, I was a lawyer in San Francisco and engaged to this woman. Who was living in Palo Alto while I'd been and then we got engaged and I got a job in Los Angeles. I moved down here. So the latter months of our engagement, we were living in separate cities.
Right.
And she started to get cold feet and she was seeing the signs of my alcoholism eking out all over the place. And we ended up going through with the wedding. But what I didn't realize at the time is she really had no plans for actually being married to me, mm-hmm. but she was too, how do I explain it? I mean, I think she wanted me to call it off.
Right.
And she was
right.
sending me all these signals, like, please call off this wedding without actually saying it. And I was sort of being
the nice codependent.
Yeah, like trying to make her feel comfortable.
Right.
Or, you know, and where she just wanted me to beat it, you know.
Right.
And when I didn't call it off, and then we were kind of stuck in this scenario, we actually went through with the ceremony and, you know, sort of like everybody you love in this one place for this,
right.
you know, for this thing. And then she didn't want to sign the marriage certificate. So that was a whole other saga.
Yeah,
so we ended up not selling, we ended up not actually consummating it either physically or on paper.
But everybody thought you had.
But everybody thought we had.
There.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to go on this honeymoon with her. And I was confused and alone, and I couldn't tell anybody what was happening because I was so ashamed.
Right.
And we ended up, because it had already been paid for, we went on this honeymoon anyway, and it was a horrific experience of sort of not speaking to each other until I couldn't take it anymore and said, you know, you got to go. And that's the last time I've seen her, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
There were no amends?
Well, that's a whole other thing,
yeah.
like how to make amends to that. You know, like I have a... Like, I was so angry for so long. How could this person do this to me? And blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the work in recovery has really been owning, you know, how I contributed to that. And,
right.
And for the most part, you know, I created that whole scenario. And my amends really to her is a living amends to not be like that and to let her live her life. I mean,
right.
she was having an affair the whole time. And she ended up marrying this guy that she was having an affair with when we were engaged and all this, you know, insanity.
Right, right.
And in my book, I was very clear to kind of, you know, tell her, you know, that that I was sorry.
And you haven't heard yet.
I haven't heard from her.
Right.
I would imagine, I can't imagine she's unaware of that, but it's
right.
not like there's been any
right.
exchange.
Right, right. So, okay, but so you despite your developing alcoholism, you graduate from law school.
Mm-hmm. Somehow.
Somehow. I mean, law school's not easy,
but you did that. Yeah, I would like, I don't know how that happened, but I did.
You weren't even on any of the good stimulant drugs, so I don't know.
I know. Somehow I got through that.
Okay.
And I got a good job. You know, I got a good job in a law firm in San Francisco, and I wasn't into it, though. Like, literally,
right.
I was terrible because I was trying to do the least amount of work possible and not get fired. And I was, frankly, I was bored in San Francisco, and I wanted to be more in entertainment-related work, and I did get a job down here.
What kind of law were you practicing?
I was doing, at that time, I was doing, like, employment law litigation
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. And I wanted to come down here, and I did get a job down here at a pretty cool firm that was doing some interesting things. And what happened was, you know, when you're living in San Francisco, I could go out really late and get really drunk and figure out how to drive my car on back streets and not get pulled over and... You know, I'd wake up and not know where I'd park my car and, you know, ride a mountain bike around the neighborhood looking for it.
Right.
that kind of stuff.
I lived in San Francisco. It's not quite as easy to get to be a drunk there as you're making it.
Well, what
sound,
my point being that when I moved to Los Angeles, it was very different. Like I got a DUI almost like immediately, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then it was a wake up call because the police, you know, the way they treat you in Los Angeles is very different. You know, they treat you like, you're on crack, you've got a shotgun, you know, under the seat, right. and you stole a car, and there's a dead body in the trunk.
Right.
You know? And that's the way you're, and I suppose they have to do that. But I got two DUIs in like 6 weeks.
But that's also bad luck. Yeah. I mean, whatever. I drove drunk here for years, never did. But
I
got,
I think I got pulled over like maybe, I don't know, 12 or 15 times in my whole life and never actually got a DUI until I came here. So it was about time.
Right. You know,
my number was up.
Yeah. So you got these DUIs and you said, and they made you do a court card. Is that how you came?
Yeah, to do all that. And I would like forge the signatures on the court card. And I mean, after the first one, I was like, well, everybody gets a DUI.
Right.
And then when I got the second one and they were like, you're going to jail. You know, I was like, that was a reckoning moment of realizing like, yeah, you're a little bit, I mean, of course I always knew I was an alcoholic, but there's that, there's a difference between that knowledge and actually taking action to like confront it.
When you say you always knew, what do you mean? Like from that first time?
I think on a very unconscious level the first time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then, it, you know, it became clear to me in a not very long period of time that, you know, my drinking was different than everyone else, or, you know, I was that, you know, why am I always the last guy to leave the party, and why am I drinking, you know, in college, why am I drinking the beers that are sitting around at the party with cigarette butts in them, and you know, things like that, like other people aren't doing that, and, you know, going out two nights a week, went to three nights a week, went to four nights a week, until, you know, it's like my life was degrading and other people were just having fun, and so I knew like that I was different, and you know, you're kind of trying to manage it because you don't want to give it up. So you're trying to create these checks and balances on it. But I always knew, like, someday this is going to be, you know, probably more of a problem than I would like it to be.
And so then that day came. And did you go, you didn't go into treatment anywhere. You just went to
not initially. Ultimately, I did, yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, I took a stab at, like, trying to get sober by showing up in the rooms. But, you know, I wasn't ready to give myself over to it, you know.
Right.
I was a tourist, you know. I'd come in late, sit in the back, try not to talk to anybody.
Right. Get out,
you know,
there.
Get my court card
signed.
Yeah. Exactly.
Creepy things like that.
And then I could say like I'm in it. You
know,
but I kept relapsing. I was just a habitual relapser, in and out.
Right.
And then it just got darker and darker and darker and less fun. And the fun was gone. And at the end, you know, I was drinking vodka tonics in the shower and you know, cradling a tall boy between my legs, driving to work and hiding, you know, sneaking drinks in the day and hiding empties. And you know, on the verge of, when I got my second DUI, my boss knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was this story, like he was handling some excessive force cases with the LAPD and the Beverly Hills Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
And my second DUI, I got 0.27 and 0.29. So I was low. Yeah,
right.
Like, I was way gone, right?
Right.
And the second one, I was going the wrong way down a one-way street in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
At like 3 a.m.
Not good.
And the cop who arrested me took my, when they take all your stuff, he saw my business card. And he's like, I know this firm, you know, like.
Right.
And he called my boss and he said, I picked up one of your boys. So my boss like knew. He calls me into his office, you know, and he's like, what's going on? You know, and I'm like, am I getting fired? It's like, you're not getting fired, but you got to deal with what's going on. And so the volume's getting turned up.
Right.
And relapse, until one day, you know, I just woke up one morning hungover and it was not too dissimilar from so many others and just had that willingness to do something different. And it had been suggested to me by my parents, who really didn't want to talk to me until I was ready to deal with the problem, that, you know, I should check out treatment. And just that day I was like, okay, I'll go. Like I was just, I'd had enough. I was desperate. And that night I was on a plane and it was called Springbrook. Now it's owned by Hazleton, but it's outside Portland.
No, oh, okay.
Yeah, it was called Springbrook Northwest. And it's since been acquired by Hazleton. So it is a Hazleton now, but it's like in farmland, like maybe an hour outside of Portland.
And it worked. Like you got
it
there.
It worked. Yeah. I mean, I was like, I showed up thinking, you know, I got to get back to work and you know, I'm going to stay here maybe 3 weeks. I'm going to clean the pipes out and I got to hustle back because I'm so important.
Very important.
You know, how's the world going to function without me?
Yeah.
And for the first time though, because I had that willingness, and as you know, like it's all about willingness.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time I had to kind of relate honestly about how I was living my life. And I remember one of the first kind of assignments or tasks we had to do was to write down 10 incidents of where you're drinking or using like got you into trouble.
Oh, okay.
Or like, here was what I was planning to do. Like, I'm going to meet a friend for a drink, you know, and then here's what actually happened. And you tell this terrible story of where it led you, how that affected you and how that affected other people in your life. And then you had to read it aloud, like in front of like 60 people. And I did that honestly. And they were like, yeah, you have the alcoholism we typically see in like a 65-year-old man. Like, we think you ought to think about sticking around a little bit longer than a couple weeks. And it's like, it's up to you, you know, but you know, this is our suggestion.
How long did you stay?
And so I stayed for 100 days.
Wow. Good for you.
And, that changed everything. Yeah. It changed my life and it saved my life.
And so, and then you came back and you got serious about, you know, making it a priority in your life.
Right. So I came back and it was all about building a foundation of sobriety. So I was going to at least a meeting a day, if not two meetings a day.
Right.
And I was living in Santa Monica at the time, but I had a morning commitment at a popular meeting in West Hollywood.
That's how we knew each other.
Yeah, yeah. So
from that meeting.
Right. And went to that meeting every day.
Yeah.
Now we're skirting on that line of like...
Whatever. I know. I mean, if you don't say the name of it, it's fine. We gathered at 7:30 in the morning with like 100 other people, and it was good, and it was important, and it saved my life.
And what was interesting about it for me was that it defied every expectation of what I thought recovery was about.
Mm-hmm.
Because other sort of gatherings, if you will, that I'd been to were kind of more in line with what you would conjure up as your expectation for what these meetings are.
Oh, your worst nightmare with the toothless.
And this was different because there were all these young people.
Yeah.
And they were cool. And they were like interesting and creative and they looked happy. And they were like people that I'm like, these are people I could be friends with.
Right.
And I didn't know that that was possible.
I know. I had the same experience.
You know? Because I thought I was just going to be hanging out with old dudes in trench coats, chain smoking.
And you were okay with that.
And I was ready to do that
because
I was that desperate. But when I realized like there's this incredible vitality and energy around sobriety, in particular young people in sobriety in Los Angeles, I just grabbed onto that with everything.
Yeah.
And the people that I met at that particular, there's, you know, it's now 16 years later, whatever.
Oh,
they're still like my best friends.
Really?
You know,
so the people you know from there, you still talk to all
the
time?
All the time.
Yeah. And so then you were able to, you know, build this great life, meet the woman, start having the kids, build up the law practice.
Right. So that it was like, you know, when I was 18, you know, the world was my oyster. I was like on this pedestal, like, oh my God, he's this amazing talented swimmer and he's, you know, academically on top of the world. Like, he's our next senator. You know, it's like that kind of a thing. You
right.
know? And I squandered all that, you know, and I destroyed all that. So, you know, it was time to, you know, make hay trying to like repair all the wreckage that I
did. You feel like created. That again in sobriety? Like you had all, you know, the world at your fingertips or no?
No, I felt like I needed to claw my way back up to just a modicum of respectability.
Right.
But the interesting thing that happened was very quickly, like what happens when you're newly sober is you're compelled to look inside yourself.
Yeah.
And it's an inside job, as they say. And if you do that with honesty and with rigor, you will discover many things about yourself. And it became clear to me that I'd never really developed a healthy relationship with who I was or really was in touch with what I wanted to do or what I wanted to share. And as if I was living someone else's life. Like my whole life was about the American dream, you know, study hard, get good grades, go to the good school and get the good job and kind of, you know, climb the ladder.
Right.
And this is how you become not just a responsible member of society, but a happy person.
Right.
And as I was starting to kind of do that again and what my experience prior to getting sober, I realized like, I'm not happy doing that. This is not the life for me. And so I realized that I was going to be probably embarking in a different trajectory, much to the chagrin of my parents, I suppose. I'm sure. Like, I'm sure. You know, I don't know that this mantle of, you know, being a, you know, a partner in a law firm is really the right tact for me. I can will myself into it. I'm smart enough to do it.
Right.
But it's like jamming a square peg into a round hole.
Right.
So I did go back, and I was at the law firm, and I was trying to do all the right things. And as I got more and more sober, that life became more and more incompatible with like what I wanted to do and who I was. And that created like a interpersonal crisis that I had to reconcile.
Would I have a question before we get into your interpersonal crisis? Did you like bicycle over here, or do we need to worry about your meter?
No, I drove. I parked on the side street over there. There wasn't even a meter.
Okay, well, that's because you're just a little bit smarter than my previous guests. Usually, there is an incident where we have to stop, and I don't sound at it.
So Anna, as a podcasting veteran, I may have to take a bathroom break, but I will not have to go change the meter.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Should we take our bathroom break now?
Do you have to go?
No, I can keep going. I'm inhuman. I don't know. Okay, no.
Right. How long do we go for?
7 hours. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Well, we like to go... If you've ever done a race, we like to go as long as that race. Yeah, three days.
Okay.
And I thought, though, that race was without sleeping, so we're not going to sleep. No, I don't know. We go
well, with my show, I just go. I go as long as the conversation is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? Like some people are like, our time is up. And I'm like, why is our time up?
Yeah.
We're just having, you know, you don't say that when you're having a conversation with someone.
Right. If only we could. If only that was societally acceptable.
But that's the beauty of podcasting. You don't have to be in a radio format.
No, I know. I love it. I just love that you get to hear people, you know, not give the scripted answers and to make mistakes and, you know, all of that stuff. So, but so, okay. And so then this is around the time of your 40th birthday when you get winded walking up the stairs, right?
I know, sort of.
I mean, right?
You've done your homework.
Well, you know, I know bits of the myth.
Yeah. I mean, I think what had been happening was, you know, here I am like jamming this square peg into a round hole and like, you know, it's sort of like what Henry David Thoreau said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation.
Right.
And what is considered resignation is confirmed desperation.
Oh, I never, ever hear the second part.
That's the full part. That's the full quote.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it was true in his time and maybe even more true now, but certainly true in my life. You know, I was like, I was in an existence where I was getting paid really well. And I was trying to, you know, do all the right things and really unhappy, like, but feeling like I was in this prison I didn't know how to escape because it was all I knew. And so what do? I spend all my money on things that I think are going to make me happy and buy a fancy car and all that kind of stuff. And meanwhile, I'm medicating my emotions through the foods that I'm choosing to eat. So I'm eating a lot of crap food. I'm eating McDonald's and Pizza Hut and just Jack in the Box. And, you know, really, and it wasn't until many years later that I realized how much of that was emotional. And, you know, and I was used to being an athlete and swimming and I could just eat whatever I wanted and it didn't matter. But, you know, I was sitting at a desk, you know, for many years I've just been sitting at a desk and packed on like 50 pounds and I was never like super obese or anything.
So is this when I, like our conversation by the, like on the 4th of July was around then? Because I don't ever remember you being
I don't, what year was that?
That was 2001 or 2002.
Yeah, no, this started to really ramp up like around a couple years later than that, I suppose. So I was like, I mean, I got like, you know, I got all beefed out, you know, I had the big round head and, you know, I just looked like a guy who's working too much at the law firm. You know, it wasn't like that unusual, but it was more like how I felt inside. Like I just felt like I was dying, you know?
Right.
And it all came to a head like shortly before I turned 40 and had this moment walking up the stairs, going to bed late one night and, you know, had to take a break halfway up a staircase and, you know, winded, out of breath. Sweat on my brow and tightness in my chest. And, you know, it's not like I was having a heart attack, but it was scary enough to make me really, you know, take stock of how I was living my life and my lifestyle choices. And, you know, when you, it all goes back to recovery because when you have that sort of moment of clarity and you decide you're going to get sober, you realize the power of that moment, you know, and that we all have these moments in our life where we can make these decisions. And if we're able to, you know, summon the courage to do that, that your life can change in a profound way.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're saying that, because I do not I have had that experience with drugs and alcohol, and I've had that experience with smoking cigarettes, but I have never had that experience about anything else. Where,
but maybe you're a happily adjusted person who's living. You're a
make
very,
no mistake. There is no way that's true.
But you're pretty actualized in the sense that you are, you know, a creative person. You're in your, you know, you're in your creative power, and you know what you have to offer, and you're engaged.
But
in
there's
that.
A lot that I would love to be able to do that with. There's stuff right now where I wish I could make that decision, and then just like with 12 step, what was amazing was that there was just do this, go here, say that, call this, read this. Whereas in life, there isn't something like that.
Right. I think pain is the great motivator. You know, if you're in enough pain over something, then you can
I know how to
harness that. Yeah. The trick is to be able to do that when you're not in that, to understand you have that power within you all the time, and you don't have to be in a terrible place of suffering in order to make that change. That's the hard
part. Nobody's willing. I mean, I'm barely willing when I'm in that kind of pain.
I know.
You know?
Believe me, I know.
So, because your wife already had healthy eating, do you think, so you knew at least the first step was to do this cleanse, right?
Well, what happened was, so I have this moment and I'm thinking, you know, I got to change, and I need to change now. Like it has to happen immediately, and it has to be specific, because I know, like, if I just blow it off, that I'll just go back to doing what I was doing before, just like a relapse.
Right.
And you know, I grabbed onto my wife because she was a healthier person than me. I didn't like go read a bunch of books or anything like that. She was just what was available to me. And the interesting thing about that is that she had been trying sort of unsuccessfully for many years to try to introduce me to this or that. Like, you know, even though I'm in recovery and it's a spiritual program, she was a much more spiritually developed individual than I was. Like, she's always reading books from this guru or that and trying to develop her, you know, kind of personal growth and all these sorts of things. And she'd be like, read this book. Why don't you read this book? Or this guy has something interesting to say. Or like, why don't we start eating this way? And the more she kind of pushed, the more resistant I was. I was like, leave me alone, you know? And then she kind of had a moment where she's like, all right, I have a decision to make. Like, either I'm going to continue to try to compel him to do something that he doesn't want to do, or I'm going to truly, like, just be in acceptance of who he is. Like, I'm married to this guy. I'm going to choose to love him the way that he is. And I'm going to honestly, like, in my heart, like, let go of my need or desire for him to be anything different than he is.
Right.
And when that shifted, which was around this same time, like, I could feel that energy change. And I was like, oh, like, I mean, it's on me. Like, I actually, like, have to make this decision for myself.
That's interesting.
Which is kind of like an Al-Anon kind of thing, right? You know, and I think that was powerful, because it really did make me have to take responsibility. And all these things kind of dovetailed around the same time. So that's what I did. I did this, like, juice cleanse, which was like, you know, detoxing off heroin. It was terrible.
Really? You were sick?
The first, like, day and a half, I was, like, buckled over on the couch. I couldn't move. And it was horrible. But you know, it's like, you know, if there's one thing we know how to do, it's like, what we know what a detox is like. We know, like, it'll get better if we just stick with it or whatever.
Right.
And by the end of that period, that little experiment, I really did feel incredible. Like, I felt better than I'd felt as long as I could remember, you know, maybe ever. You know, the extent to which my vitality, like, spiked was extraordinary.
Right.
Like, I couldn't believe how good I could feel in such a short period of time by doing this simple thing.
Right.
And it made me really think about or understand how resilient the human body is. You know, that in especially, like, drugs, alcohol, unhealthy lifestyle, stress, you know, fast food, all these sorts of things that I've been, like, abusing myself with for so long, that in, like, literally a week I could feel differently. Like, that's crazy.
Right. You know? That's a powerful system we got going here.
Right.
And so now it's all plant-based, everything that you eat.
Well, not at that time. I mean, now it is, yeah.
Right.
So I've kind of, that's how it's evolved. I mean, it wasn't like an overnight thing. I mean, I did this juice cleanse and I'm like, I want to continue to feel this good. How am I going to do that? And I played around with, you know, different ways of eating, and I experimented with being a vegetarian, not because I had some extraordinary compassion for the animals, but I thought it made sense to me in a recovery context, because in recovery, it's very black and white. You know, you're either drinking or you're not, you know, you're sober or you're using,
right.
There's no gray area. And like of all the kind of diets, like, oh, well, if you're a vegetarian, it's kind of the same. It's an analog,
right.
You know,
right.
It's like you're eating meat or you're not. Like I could wrap my brain around, like that made sense to me,
right.
Because I see the world through this prism of recovery.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's very black. Most right. alcoholics see it as black mm-hmm. and white anyway.
But the problem is that, you know, I'm also a lawyer, so I'm looking for the loopholes. And, you know, it's
right.
like, well, I could eat Pizza Hut if I don't put pepperoni on the pizza.
Right.
Like, that's vegetarian, you know.
Right.
So I started doing cheating, and I wasn't doing it right. I wasn't really eating very healthy. And I did that for, like, 6 months. And, you know, it was back to, like, sitting on the couch and, you know, not losing any weight, not feeling good. And was ready to just kind of give up on this whole idea of, like, trying to eat healthy. And I thought, well, maybe I wonder what would happen if I got rid of, you know, all the animal products, got rid of the dairy and got rid of this processed food. I wonder if that would make any difference. And I did that. I didn't have any expectation that would make any difference, really. I thought, you know, I'll do this. And then I can honestly go back to eating the way that I was and say that I tried everything.
Right.
But I stepped into that. And then within like 7 to 10 days of making that switch, I felt like I felt when I did that cleanse, like I felt amazing. And so it's been a process of building on that ever since. So yeah, I've been completely plant-based for about 7 years, over 7 years now.
Mm-hmm. And you ultimately, you're not practicing law at all anymore?
No, I stopped practicing when my book came out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in the wake of kind of changing my diet and having all this energy, like, that's when I started, like, trying to get fit again. Not because I had no plan of returning to becoming a competitive athlete. That was never part
right.
of the equation. It was just, I had so much energy, I needed to burn it off because I couldn't sit down, I couldn't focus, and I just wanted to lose a little bit of weight and enjoy my kids at their energy level, and that was really it. But the more
right.
I did it, the more I realized I had this capacity for it, and the more I enjoyed it. And I just enjoyed feeling my body again after
right.
so many years, like connecting with myself and being out in nature. And there was something very primal about it. And it was also like very much an active meditation for me.
Right.
And really kind of one thing led to another. And, you know, sort of, you know, I started... what happened was really that this idea of how resilient the human body, I couldn't shake this idea. And I thought, well, if I could feel this good, like how, I wanted to test that. Like
right.
how, if I could feel this good so quickly, what actually am I capable of physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually? And I needed a challenge to test that, you know, to
right.
really like see where I could go with it. And that's how the Ultraman thing kind of transpired. It wasn't like, I'm going to go beat a bunch of people in a race. It was like, I wanted to have a spiritual experience. I wanted to see what I was actually, what my physical, emotional, spiritual, and mental limitations were. And that seemed to be the ultimate thing because it was so incomprehensible.
Right. So what role does spirituality play in this?
It's all spiritual.
Right.
For me, I mean, it's much more spiritual than it is athletic, you know, and the whole reason that it inspired me to get involved in it was to learn something about myself, you know, develop a greater understanding of what makes me tick. And I think when you're in that this kind of an endeavor that's so challenging physically, that it really makes you, it's sort of like when you're in recovery, like you don't really figure out what your character defects are until you're in a relationship, right?
Right.
You know, because it brings it out.
Well, until enough time passes
that
you
can't
ignore it.
Right, right. But this was a way of really kind of confronting a lot about myself, because you're in so much pain or you're, you know, you're forced to kind of make choices about, you know, what you can tolerate and what you can't, that it really, the more I did it, the more I was learning about myself. And it's been really just that.
And the editor, this is a very sloppy transition. It's not where my skills
at life.
We filled
up the memory card.
We did so much to say.
Yeah.
But so we were sort of, we were working towards the, you know, current day, basically.
Right.
We were getting current, as
right.
they say.
Yeah, what were we talking about?
You know, it was very profound and very meaningful. That part I know, but the specifics I don't recall. But basically, let's talk about, okay, here's what I want to do, and maybe in doing that we'll get back to it somehow. In order to stay sober today, what do you do?
Still very active in my recovery, and I would say that, I mean, first and foremost, you know, I'm by no means any kind of shining example of sobriety or recovery.
Yeah, join the club.
I stumble and I make mistakes all the time.
Right.
And I don't do it perfectly, and it's been hard. You know, it's been hard. It's been hard, and it's weird to have written a book where there's like a recovery story, because then it, sort of implicit in that is this idea that you've conquered it. You know, and this is in your past, and that's not the case, and that's not how I perceive it. It requires a lot of work for me to be on top of it, and you know, I have this persistent illusion that I can be on cruise control. You know,
yeah.
And
millions of other alcoholics.
It was made very clear to me very early in sobriety that there is no stasis. You're either moving towards a relapse or you're moving towards, you know, greater health and recovery. And there's no standstill.
Right.
But I continue to try to convince myself
that it'll be different. Or that you just forget.
And so my experience has been, you know, I cruise until I'm in enough pain, and then I address that.
Shift gears.
And then I take my will back and try to run my own life myself
until
that stops working again. You know, I've never lost touch with the program. I continue to be, you know, my life is about that, you know. But it would be dishonest to say that I wake up every day and every single day that I put sobriety first, you know,
like
that's, you know, when I do, my life is better. But more often than not, I'm putting other things ahead of that until that causes problems in my life. And I have to remember because I forget.
Right. I mean, I definitely relate to that. And I think what's interesting is you can be telling yourself you're putting it first and doing 12-step and sharing and sponsoring, doing all of these things and still not be doing it at all.
Right.
You know, and the other thing is, I think in terms of putting oneself out there, I do think, you know, because I worry about that too. Like, I just hope with all the, like for me, like all the fucked up stuff I write, like at least people understand that, like, I'm the furthest thing from claiming I got this.
Right.
Like, you know, most sober people who are talking about it are not saying like, oh, look at me, do it like I did. We're just saying, You can do, this is possible.
Right.
You may be more of a mess than me. You may not be nearly as much of a mess as me, but you know, I think it's hard because, you know, I think you have to work really hard to make it really clear that you're not holding yourself up as some example.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, people out there, they want to look at somebody as an example of somebody who has succeeded so they can hold on to that as like a lifeline. And I recognize that, you know, sort of, you know, you probably fill that role for a lot of people. And from time to time, I do. But it's
God
like,
not.
I don't, I mean, you know, this is like, you know, we have good days and bad days.
Yeah. But I think that I think it's really, really hard because, you know, you sort of get sober and you're like, yes, surrender, drugs, alcohol. And many of us have this extremely profound experience of having that desire removed. And then for me, it was like, and then suddenly all these jobs I kept getting fired from, suddenly like the world seemed to be saying yes to me. And, oh, you really think I'm going to surrender that? Are you kidding me?
Right.
And, you know, sobriety has been learning that I actually, the more I think I can control, the more miserable I'm going to be.
Right. The road gets narrower and certain, you know, behavior patterns and habits and proclivities become, as you continue to grow and kind of live your life, hopefully become less and less acceptable to you until you have to sort of confront them and weed them out of your existence. And, you know, but I'm very in touch every single day with the fact that the life that I live today, this amazing life that I've been blessed with, is really only because I got sober and work on my sobriety every single day in some form or another.
Right. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the recent news of you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, we learned he overdosed, mm-hmm. you know, this is that same week. I'm releasing it later, but right. not much.
It was a couple days ago.
Yeah. And, you know, that news hit people really hard, you know, most of whom didn't know him, and the media sort of had its spin. I thought the media, I was impressed with many, many of the pieces that I read.
Right.
But we were talking a little bit during the break. You didn't, what was your reaction to the response?
I was deeply moved by it and very aggrieved. And, you know, Philip, I was not friends with Philip. I had a good occasion to have met him on several occasions, but I wouldn't even say that we were that acquainted. But I'm close with his mom and know his family more than I know him. And and it really, it deeply, deeply affected me to the point where, I mean, I'm somebody who sometimes I feel like Dexter, you know, who's like peering in on two people having an authentic, intimate interaction and trying and confused,
right.
like trying to figure out what a normal person
I've never
would
seen
do.
It. Or, that, is that like
well,
before
he's kind
he kills
of like
them?
This emotionally numbed out person,
right?
You know,
right.
In
oh
addition to being a psychopath,
but like, oh my god.
The point being, like, I often flog myself and feel guilty and frankly, like, ashamed that I don't, like, when some tragedy occurs, I don't feel that emotional about it.
Right.
Like, more often than not, I'm numbed out.
Right.
You know, and I feel callous or,
right.
and then I feel guilty, but I don't feel
right.
like a normal person is supposed to feel.
Exactly. I relate to
that's
that.
My general
reaction.
Experience. But in this case, I was like, I had an emotional breakdown and I was like, it's weird because it's not like I was friends with Phil, but for other reasons and other people that are involved that you know, I feel compassion for, it definitely affected me deeply. And it's been interesting because it's not like a TMZ thing. This is a CNN thing. This is an everybody thing. This
right.
is a, you know, New York Times thing. You know, I don't know. Did you see A.O. Scott wrote a beautiful eulogy in the New York Times about him? And I was so moved by reading that. And it's so heightened because of his extraordinary
talent.
Other planetary talent.
Yeah.
That it becomes all the more poignant. And I think that what's been amazing to watch is the public's reaction to this, because it's certainly, you know, it's water cooler talk across
right.
the world. And I have this expectation that normal people will see it the way that I see it or the
right.
way that you see it, you know, because we're immersed in recovery. We have a certain perspective on what transpired and what led to that happening. And then to realize that a lot of people are in a different place with that emotionally or have judgments about it that couldn't be further or more distinct from the way that I see it.
But this can't be the first time you've noticed that the world doesn't seem to understand addiction very well.
No, but I think I can't remember a time where it was so much kind of, you know, the trending discourse.
Mm-hmm.
You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? Like, there's been other celebrity, you know,
right.
like overdoses, of course, but because he was so universally revered and kind of above reproach
right.
in every respect,
right.
it's different. It's colored differently.
Yeah.
I think it's framed differently. And then when I see somebody say, well, he made a choice, you know, and he was selfish and he left his kids behind, and it's frustrating and it's upsetting to see that there's a lot of work to be done in terms of raising awareness over, you know, how addiction actually functions.
Right, right. But even so, it's not like sober people or people who are afflicted with addiction go, oh, okay, I get exactly what happened. This is what happened. Mm-hmm. We don't really know.
No, we don't know.
You know?
Of course not. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen in a glimpse either. It was something that I feel, from an outsider's perspective, had been building for a long time and culminated in this event.
Right.
you know, these things don't happen in a vacuum, and it leaves you with a sense of powerlessness, you know, that if somebody who had so much could be taken in this way, that, you know, none of us are immune. And I think it's imperative for everybody to understand that it transcends choice. You know, when that locomotive has garnered enough steam over the last year or several months or even weeks or days, by the time that choice presents itself, that choice has already been made. There's
right.
a powerlessness to that. It becomes incapable to course correct.
Right. I mean, yeah, I just don't know that people who have not experienced that firsthand even can even fathom it. Cause they're mm-hmm. like, what do you mean? Sober 23 years. What, you know, clearly it's not a problem, you know? Right. And it is something that in my experience defies logic, which is how I sort of had my spiritual experience, is this doesn't actually logically make sense that you can right. stop doing something. And this thing you could not stop suddenly ceases to be even an issue.
Right. Or this idea that once you've accumulated time, you've somehow immunized yourself
right.
from this kind of event transpiring.
Right, right, right. Well, Rich, I think on that, you know, sobering note, mm-hmm. you know, I think we've had a good chat.
It's good, yeah.
Right?
Good.
I've enjoyed it. Have you right. have you enjoyed it?
I have. Are you going to come on my podcast now?
But don't you only talk about like super healthy things?
No.
Oh my God. Okay.
Well, listen to the Mishka episodes.
Okay. I would love.
Just when we took the break, I just said he texted me. So there's
the bromance serendipitous, is alive. Well, is it serendipitous or are you guys just texting 24/7?
No. I mean, every couple days, you know? So like the fact that he would text while I'm sitting here with
I
you.
I want to be, can up, we make so. It a triumvirate? Do you think that if I take up like athletics in a serious way and I start trying to bro out with you guys, the three of us can no okay yeah, okay yeah. look I'll start with just want. Going on your podcast that's yeah. that's good enough for me.
Actually, it'd be pretty fun to have the three of us do it together if we can get all in the same room somehow.
Let's make it happen. So, okay, Rich, right. thank you so much for all doing right. this. It
Thanks
really is an
me.
Honor and pleasure.
Cool.
I didn't lie, right? He was good. Rich Roll, one of the world's fittest men, sober alcoholic, thoughtful, best-selling author, fellow podcaster. Check him out, richroll.com. You can follow him on Twitter at @richroll. It's R-O-L-L, lest you think it's R-O-L-E. And if you Google him, you will see, you'll be brought to new levels of what you think fitness can be. So see you next time, after partiers.